Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
From LA to Sacramento, new uncertainty in public education. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. America's second largest school district has named a new superintendent with no national search and no public input. And the school board majority that chose John Daisy might not be around after the March election. In Sacramento, Governor Brown has appointed a new state board of education after firing Arnold Schwarzenegger's reformers. What will it all mean for teacher evaluation, charter schools, and educating kids during a real financial crisis? Later on, Arizona's toxic mixture of guns and anger. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. In the aftermath of Saturday's shooting, Arizona is a state divided. Should gun laws be strengthened or made more permissive? Have the economy and illegal immigration created a dangerously toxic atmosphere? We'll hear different answers to those questions later on. First, the LA Unified School District has a new superintendent, John Daisy, who's been assistant to retiring Ramon Cortinas for the past few months. The vote of the elected school board was 6-0 with one abstention. Tamar Gallatson was one of the six who voted for him. She represents District 3 in the San Fernando Valley. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
Why Mr. Daisy?
Because he has the right mix that we need here in the district. He has experience being a superintendent outside of LA. He has experience within Los Angeles. He has experience, out in with the Gates Foundation. He has national stature on education issues. And in the time that he's been here, I have been so impressed, and the parents and teachers and community members that who have worked with him have really been impressed that he understands the sense of urgency. He's smart. He's creative. He's willing to lead us through this horrible budget crisis and really come out on the other end with higher test scores and high graduation rates.
He's been superintendent in Santa Monica, Malibu in the past and also in Maryland. How does the LA Unified School District compare in terms of size and economic troubles?
Well, we're obviously bigger than anybody except for New York, so no one really compares to us. You know, Daisy's background is interesting because, you know, Santa Monica, Malibu, obviously a smaller district and relatively affluent. In Prince George's County in Maryland, obviously a very poor district with a lot of issues involving poverty. So he has had experiences in kind of two things that our district is facing. I mean, we have middle-class schools that are doing very well that have absolutely no money to work with, and we have a lot of schools that are struggling academically and a lot of families in Los Angeles that are really turning to the school district for many services. So he has experience with both kinds of districts.
Steve Zimmer is the Los Angeles Unified School District board member for District 4, which includes Hollywood, West Hollywood, the West Side, and the Valley. He is the one who abstained from the vote today. Steve Zimmer, welcome to back.
Thank you. Thank you, Warren.
Why'd you abstain?
Well, the abstention was really the only vote that I felt that I could make in this circumstance. I don't disagree with anything that Tamar said about John Daisy's qualifications. Where my quarrel is with the process or the lack thereof. And for me personally as a board member, I really had hoped to have the opportunity to have folks apply for this position. I believe that this is the most important job in public education in the nation, bar none. And it was important to me to have the opportunity to interview for this, to set some criteria, to get some input from folks around this, so that I felt that I could make the most informed decision possible for the children and the families and the teachers, employees of this district.
Back to Tamara Gallatin. There it is. No application process, no nationwide search for the second largest district, as you pointed out, in the United States. No public input. Why not?
We've been looking for deputy superintendents to Ray Cortinas for over a year now. It was no secret that Superintendent Cortinas was leaving, and we went on a nationwide hunt for two or three deputy superintendents. We talked to kind of everyone who has the kind of stature that we need throughout the entire country. And John Dacey was interested. We've basically given him an on the job tryout for the last few months. We've thrown incredibly difficult issues at him. You know, he's gone around the district speaking. He's spoken to so many of our partners, both labor and business and community. They have all given input on the fact that he is qualified to be our next superintendent.
So, Steve Zimmer, what about it? The nationwide search took place already. Dacey got to be assistant superintendent as a result, and now he's been tested.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, Warren. I think that we do have our leader, and we all need to come together around John Dacey. John Dacey needs all the support of this community and this board as much as we need John Dacey. I disagree with Tamar that we interviewed and have a national search for deputy superintendent. John Dacey was the only person I interviewed for deputy superintendent, and it was for that position. I do believe that we and Dr. Dacey himself deserved more of a process, but that's behind us now, and we need to move forward. We need to move forward together. There are children in struggling schools all throughout the city. There are teachers who are doing everything they can to serve those students throughout the city, and we need John Daisy's leadership, and we need to move forward from this point.
Tamar Gallatin, back to you. What does this mean for school reform efforts, charter schools, and all of that?
You know, I think that this means that the board has selected someone who is kind of creative and inquisitive about what else is out there, but he also understands the need to give schools flexibility. I mean, we are facing, two more years minimum of really an epic budget crisis, and it cannot be politics as usual here at LAUSD. We are in the middle of some reforms that people could only dream about a few years ago, and I am comfortable that he is on the same page with us and really help us work together and go forward and really change the face of education in Los Angeles.
Ms. Gallatin, the four of you will be up for re-election or will leave the board in March. Is there any chance that a new board might be elected that wouldn't agree with your choice?
There certainly is that possibility, and the board structured the contract for Dr. Dacey, so if a subsequent board wanted to let him go, they could do so without the crazy kind of buyout that existed in Superintendent Brewer's package prior to both board member Zimmer and I joining the board. So if that really was the intention of a new board, they could. I don't know why they would. There are not that many people in this country of the caliber of Dr. Dacey.
Back to Steve Zimmer. What's your take on just how troubled the school district is and how urgent it is to get a handle on it?
We all agree about the urgency. We are making important improvements, and under Ray Cortinas' leadership, we've made gains that no one thought we could in the midst of the worst budget crisis in recent California history. So I'm very proud of the work that our entire LAUSD family has done. But we don't need to look far to know that there are still schools that are struggling. We cannot be satisfied with where we are in terms of our proficiency rates and graduation rates. We need to move forward with dramatic speed. But even as we move forward with that due speed, we have to pay attention to our periphery vision as well and make sure that everybody is included as we move forward. this process, or lack thereof, is not the model that I would use to move forward. But John Daisy, I think in the end, will be the leader who takes us to that level of achievement that Ray Cortinez and the LAUSD family has built the foundation for, that everybody that who lives in Los Angeles expects from our public education system. And I look forward to being a partner and being part of that.
Ms. Gallatin, you've both stepped out, as I understand it, of an ongoing meeting of the board. And one of the things it has to do is a contract with the teachers union. What progress has been made in that regard?
We are in ongoing negotiations with regard to what's going to go on with the contract with not just the teachers, but really all of our employees. Yesterday, Jerry Brown, indicated what kind of budget we're going to be looking at. It's going to depend a lot on if voters choose to tax themselves for public education. You know, the 2012-13 year, everyone knows, is probably the worst one that we've seen yet. So we are keeping our eye down the road on that. And our labor partners do understand how bad it is.
Steve Zimmer, what about the teachers union contract? How's that going?
Well, I think we have to remember, Warren, that last year all of our employees made sacrifices that nobody was expecting. And it's only through those sacrifices that the district remained whole. We were also able to convince Congress to pass the Education Jobs Bill. That is going to secure, I hope, class sizes for this year and not cause the large-scale rift in year 11-12 that we've suffered in recent years. I share Tamar's concerns about 12-13, and we're all going to need to come together, and we're all going to need to make sure that the number one priority is our students and their achievement. And when we stay focused on that, and when we put kids first, as all of our labor partners did last year, we can achieve things together that no one expects us to. And so I fully expect that our labor partners will join us in looking to the federal government for increased revenue and then making the sacrifices that we all need to make to keep this district whole.
Okay. Both members of the LA Unified School District Board, Steve Zimmer, who abstained from today's appointment of John Daisy, and Tamar Gallatin, who was part of the six-vote majority that elected him. Thanks to you both for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
We're joined with A.J. Duffy, who's president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. He's been listening to this conversation. And A.J. Duffy, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
I understand you would agree with Steve Zimmer about the lack of a process in choosing John Daisy, but it's over now. How do you feel about Daisy himself?
Well, look, I want to underscore the fact that I do not agree with Tamar. There was not an open, transparent process. Stakeholders were not involved, particularly teachers and parents. And since we're the key stakeholders, we should have been part of the process. Having said that, we will work with Dr. Daisy. We will press aggressively what we consider to be a student-centered, progressive agenda for school reform that will include keeping class sizes as low as possible, working with the district to raise revenues. We're already at the table, formally and informally, talking about creating an evaluation system that's fair and equitable to teachers, that works for kids, and one that truly supports teaching and learning in the classroom. No evaluation system works unless it does those two things, supports teaching and learning in the classroom. And we're going to be talking about a lot of other issues that we believe are critical to raising the standard of education in Los Angeles for all of our students. But we also need to point out that there are genuine oases of excellence that exist within the system. And we want to make sure that the LA community understands that although much work needs to be done in many areas, there's so much good going on in this district, and it cannot be lost. Teachers and health and human service professionals, classified and administrators and parents have really pulled together in the last couple of years to make the kind of gains that Steve and Tamar talked about possible.
Again, A.J. Duffy is president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. Caprice Young is former president of the L.A. Board of Education. She's now CEO of a charter school group called Inner City Education Foundation Public Schools, or ICEF. Good to have you on our show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Good. What about the process? What about John Dacey?
Well, first of all, I think John Dacey's a home run. And the fact that LA Unified has been able to attract someone of such high caliber is really a credit to the current school board. That's extraordinary. And so, first of all, kudos. Second of all, you know, when I was on the school board almost a decade ago, I experienced two different times where we hired a superintendent. We hired Ray Cortinas after Ruben Zacharias left. And when we did that, we did it very directly without public input because we knew that he was the right person to deal with the challenges at the time. And later, when he left the following year, we did a very, very public, very, very thorough search for a superintendent, and that is the superintendent that we got was Roy Romer. And both of those searches or processes led to hiring somebody who was outstanding. And I think that what we need to remember is that our school board members are responsible for representing the public and the public's interest. And we depend on their wisdom and their close connection with what their constituents' concerns are to make sure that the process leads to hiring the best person, whatever the process is that they decide upon.
Let me go back to A.J. Duffy with the UTLA. Tamar Gallatin used the word flexibility in a time of financial crisis. Steve Zimmer used the word sacrifice. What does that mean when you're in the midst of contract negotiations?
Well, look, I'm not going to negotiate for my team publicly. What I will say is, to underscore what Steve said, teachers and health and human service professionals sacrificed last year. We kicked in 12 furlough days to help keep the district alive. We'll be at the table talking about all kinds of items. But I do want to underscore that the one thing that I think is critical here that we can bring to the table, and we hope Dr. Dacey will bring to the table, is true collaboration between the teachers union and the district. It's 45,000 teachers and health and human service professionals that do the job day after day. And I understand that it's Dr. Dacey's job as superintendent to give us the equipment and the training and the where, how, and wherefore to do the best job we can. But it's clear that what's necessary, what the community demands now, is collaboration, true collaboration between all the parties so that we can move together ahead and do what's right and proper for the kids.
John Rogers is professor of education at UCLA. He's also director of the Institute of Democracy Education and Access. Professor, good to have you back.
Good afternoon, Warren.
Is this a time of crisis and a kind of turning point, do you think, possibly, for the LAUSD?
John Dacey is an extremely talented school leader, and he's going to need all those talents to address a very difficult time in Los Angeles education. LA education is facing the most difficult budgetary period since the Great Depression, and it doesn't look like it's going to get any easier in the next year or two.
So what does that mean?
Well, before this recession, Los Angeles already had some of the most overcrowded classrooms and some of the most overcrowded schools in the nation. And in the wake of increasing budget cuts from the state, classrooms are now bursting at the seams. Many teachers have been laid off. Other school personnel have been furloughed. So you have extreme problems with maintaining high morale, with moving forward educational reforms when there's less resources, less support to go around.
Governor Brown has appointed a new Board of Education at the state level. I'd like to talk about that in a moment. But he's also said that the budget that he has introduced with $12 billion worth of cuts still needs another $12 billion in revenues. And he's going to put on the ballot, if he can, get the Republicans to support him in it, a choice for voters. John Rogers, how important is it to the schools, to education, public education, that voters go for that package?
Well, I think it's critically important on two different levels. So the governor has signaled that there will be a $2 billion tax effort that would be dedicated towards public education. If that doesn't go through, that means even further cuts for public schools. Other revenues, though, would go for social welfare programs and public health programs that deeply impact working communities in Los Angeles and elsewhere. And it's those health programs, it's those social welfare programs that shape how young people are coming into the schools. We need young people to come into the schools healthy and ready to learn, and so those programs are critical not just for health and social welfare, but also for education.
A.J. Duffy, if that matter gets on the ballot, as the governor has proposed, will your union support it?
Absolutely, 100%. And it's important to, for people to understand that if we don't get that, then the budget falls apart. And the doom and gloom scenario that my friend John Rogers just talked about will absolutely come true, and it will be devastating. It's tragic times we live in. And again, that's why I keep harping at the idea of collaboration between all the parties. We need to understand also that this economic crisis is not going away, but we also need to keep in mind that we should be putting our buck where it gets the biggest bang, and that's public education.
Caprice Young, again, now charter CEO of a charter school group, ISEF, in much of Los Angeles, or many parts of Los Angeles. Do you agree with what we just heard, that we really need this thing to pass?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We definitely need it to pass. I mean, California has some of the lowest funding for public schools in the country. And really, even though charter schools often do more with less, there's only so low that you can go and still deliver a high-quality public education. But the point that I'd like to make on this is that we shouldn't be thinking about it in terms of, well, how do we collaborate to make cuts? It really needs to be, how do we completely change the way we're educating our kids so that we're not trying to feed a system that we already know is broken because of the predominance of low test scores, but how do we take some of those gems that Mr. Duffy was referring to and take the lessons from those gems and redo all of public education in Los Angeles to match those kinds of opportunities at the same time as cutting the amount of money that we spend.
Once again, Governor Brown has appointed a new state board of education. Out went the reformers, including Ted Mitchell and Ben Austin. Newcomers include a well-regarded former Long Beach superintendent, Carl Kahn, Michael Kirst, who served during Brown's previous administration, and Patricia Rucker, the lobbyist for the California Teachers Association. John Rogers, what does that mean for the direction of the state board of education, which had been intervening in some ways to accomplish the kinds of reforms that Caprice Young's talking about?
Well, I think that many of the people that Governor Brown has just appointed view themselves as reformers, but view themselves, much like John Dacey, as people who are going to try to improve the overall system of education, not improve one or two schools or even a small number of charter schools. For example, Mike Kirst has been working for decades now on trying to ensure that conditions exist across all the California schools so that in front of every student is a highly qualified teacher. It's that sort of system change that I think is critical for overall improvement.
Again, A.J. Duffy, how do you feel about having the lobbyist for the California Teachers Association on the State Board of Education?
Well, I feel very good about it. Patricia knows education issues as well as anybody. And she is going to push a progressive agenda. And, I agree with both John and with Caprice. What we do need to do is change the system, change the way we deliver education. I would go farther back than just the teacher in the classroom. I think we have to be very mindful for the first time in the history of public education about who comes into the public school system. I think we need to be able to go to some of the universities and say, we're not taking your product anymore unless you start training people in a different way. I personally would like to see a time where we stop sending student-teacher candidates for observation and doing their student teaching to the best schools in the Valley or the West Side and start sending them to Normandy Avenue Elementary and Jordan High School so that they can get a real world view.
Okay, let me get back to Caprese.
What education is about today.
On the question of the Board of Education, Ted Mitchell and Ben Austin were people that I think agree with you very much on what direction reform ought to go in. They're very favorable to the idea of race to the top and what Arne Duncan is doing nationally. Are you worried that the impetus for that is going to stop?
Yeah, I'm sad to see some really strong, really committed reformers leave the board. On the other hand, some of the people that have been appointed, I think, have the potential to be as deeply reform-oriented, but from a more collaborative basis. I'm particularly excited about Carl Cohn, because he has already a track record of investing in and supporting reforms, and that's very exciting. The thing I guess I'm most disappointed about, though, is that there's nobody that's been appointed to the board who has a real background in instructional technologies. And in our schools, we're using instructional technologies so that the students and the teachers have real support and real data. And that has made a huge difference. We're seeing student gains when we have a technology-enabled instructional process that have been unheard of. And we really need to have someone on the state board that is going to be working in favor of changing the policy structure so that technology can be incorporated into the classroom and into the learning process more effectively.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Caprese Young, again, formerly with the LA School Board, now CEO of ICEF, the Charter School Group. John Rogers, professor of education at UCLA, and A.J. Duffy, president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. Hope you'll all come back to future programs. Thanks again for being with us today. Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. Arizona's toxic mixture of guns and anger on Which Way LA. Well, I'm only back with Which Way LA. President Obama will be in Tucson tomorrow at a memorial for the six people who died in Saturday's shooting, including federal judge John Roll. Today, the relatives and friends of many other victims made public statements. Bill Heilman's wife is in the hospital with bullet wounds. She took Christina Taylor Greene, the 9-year-old girl who was killed, to see Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords.
The Greens very much remain in our prayers every minute. They are dear, sweet friends of ours who have been, from the get-go, trying their best to take care of Susie despite the loss that they personally suffered. The graciousness that that couple has shown, given the tragedy that they've experienced, is unlike anything I've ever experienced. And beyond the safety of my wife and those of the other victims, I most pray for John and Roxana Green.
Dr. Michael LaMole summed up the condition of Congresswoman Giffords.
A penetrating injury through the skull, really, the survival, let alone recovery, is abysmal. She has no right to look this good, and she does. We're hopeful, but I do want to underscore the seriousness of this injury and the fact that we all have to be extremely patient.
Arizonans, in the meantime, are divided about the direction of their state. Giffords, who seems to have been the shooter's main target, warned during last year's re-election campaign that the rhetoric is incredibly heated. But she felt safe enough last Saturday to hold one of her Congress on Your Corner events in a Safeway parking lot. E.J. Montini is political columnist at the Arizona Republic. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what your take is on what all that has been said in the past few days about Arizona, about the heated arguments that are going on there, particularly with regard to illegal immigration and about gun laws.
Well, I think that, I think we have to look at this from a couple of different angles. On the one, there's one aspect that I think is generally true. People say, well, this something like this could have happened anywhere, and we have to accept the fact that there's nothing you could do about a lone, deranged gunman. I accept that, but at the same time, it didn't happen anywhere. It happened here. And in this state, at this time, it's a very toxic political environment. People have said potentially dangerous things about one another during the long course of our immigration debate here, and then on through the political campaigns that went through this summer and the fall. And I think that in an atmosphere like that, you can think that it could contribute to something terrible like this occurring. And at the very least, after something this terrible does occur, you have an obligation, I think, to try to tone back that atmosphere, try to tone back that restore some sense of civility to that discussion.
Talking with E.J. Montini, who's political columnist at the Arizona Republic. Here's the Pima County Sheriff, Clarence Duptick, with that now-famous comment made shortly after Saturday's shooting.
The anger, the hatred, the bigotry that goes on in this country is getting to be outrageous. And unfortunately, Arizona, I think, has become sort of the capital. We have become the mecca for prejudice and bigotry.
Back to Ed Montini, political columnist at that paper, Arizona Republic. Your paper in an editorial today took the sheriff on, said there's no evidence that the politics of the state in any way contributed to this atrocity.
Yeah, I think that's what happens in a situation like that, is that we get defensive. We think that that people are looking at us and thinking, oh, that must be a crazy place to live. And I think just the opposite tactic should be taken. I think that, frankly, the sheriff made a point, and I think the sheriff's point was fairly legitimate. I think in this state at this time, it's a very toxic environment, and it has been that way for quite a while. And it does go back primarily to the long and angry discussion about immigration, and particularly the SB 1070, the law that was passed in Arizona that is now working its way up through the courts, in which other states are going to pass. And it's going to continue, as Arizona is among all the other states that are going to now challenge the birthright of the 14th Amendment in legislation that's supposedly going to come up, who knows, that could come up within a week here. And that will only add to that atmosphere, which is, I think, a mistake. And I think we should take a step back. I think we should calm down. I think we should concentrate on other issues for a while, because these are the kind of issues that get people all worked up in a way that is really unhealthy.
14th Amendment, of course, passed after the Civil War, says anybody born in the United States automatically becomes
right.
A citizen. When you say tone down and look at other subjects, what about gun laws?
Right. Well, you know, the one thing that I think, Arizona gun laws, there are a number of issues that have to do with Arizona gun laws. Although, for the most part, I came to Arizona many years ago in 1980. With a very much of an East Coast perspective on weapons. I thought I moved to a place where it was crazy. There were people who could actually walk around with holstered weapons in broad daylight. I thought this is crazy. This is lunatic. But I think as you live here over time, you find that that if you look at Arizona, the crime rates here and the sense of safety here is really not much different from any other place in the country. We're fairly middle of the road as far as that goes. Where I think our gun laws have some problems are in the availability of weapons at things like gun shows. And even Senator McCain had been in the past opposed to that, the so-called gun show loophole, where a private seller could go to a gun show, sell weapons to anybody with no checks, no background checks whatsoever. Living this close to the border with Mexico, you can imagine what straw buyers can do to help arm some very bad people just south of the border here, by driving up the freeway from Nogales or someplace like that, going to a gun show and driving back across the border, taking their chances getting across. That, I think, can be dangerous. But in terms of the other things, the easy availability of guns here and stuff like that, I'm not sure that anything like that would have prevented a person like this from doing what he did.
What about the law that allows anybody without a permit to carry a concealed weapon in Arizona, anybody who's over the age of 18? Is that something that should be changed?
No. The fact of the matter is that Arizona has always been a state where you could carry a weapon openly. And so the argument became, if you can carry it openly just on your hip without any training, why should you have to have training if you're going to put it in your pocket?
Mm-hmm.
And since the fact of the matter is that you just don't have problems from the people who carry the weapons, I mean, that's just not the issue. And believe me, I looked for that kind of thing, and I don't think you see it. The problems come from more from bad guys than from good guys. And you don't have as many accidental shootings as you would think either. You know, you have this sense that, you know, children are going to be dying in the street because people walk around with guns. Well, first of all, not many people do that. And second of all, it's not comfortable. You know, you want to carry a concealed weapon, it's not an easy thing to do. They're heavy, they're unwieldy, They're not comfortable, and you're just going to lunch. What are you going to do? You know, so you don't have a whole lot of people doing that to begin with. So to a degree, I'm not buying that argument.
Ed Montini, once again, a political columnist at the Arizona Republic. Hildy Sizo is president of Arizonans for Gun Safety. She's also a criminologist. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What's your take on the gun laws, which are said to be as permissive as any in the country? I think only Alaska and Vermont allow concealed carry without a permit.
Well, I think that the gun laws issue is one of the issues that's in that environment that was just described, that it's certainly one factor among many that might have led to the horrible and horrifying massacre that occurred on Saturday. But the issue here in Arizona is that we have become the most permissive state in the country when it comes to gun laws. And we're very different from our competitors in Vermont and Alaska. While those states are have very small populations, they're very rural, we have become a very growing population and very urban. And we have urban centers where there are pockets of violence. There's quite a bit of gun violence. And in fact, our state is in the always in the top 10 of having the highest rates of gun deaths in the country. So, and it's particularly a problem among young people here in Arizona. A couple years ago, the data showed that the top injury for the death of 15 to 17-year-olds was gunshot injuries. So it is, in fact, a problem here. There are people who are impacted every day from gun violence. And so we're on a slippery slope here in Arizona. It's really been the last 2 years when our gun laws have become more and more permissive. It was 2 years ago when the legislature allowed concealed weapons to be carried into bars where alcohol is consumed. It was last year.
You can't consume alcohol, though, if you have a gun, isn't that right?
That's correct. But they are. That means there's people in an environment where alcohol is being consumed. And certainly research tells us that alcohol is a precursor to violence. So it's a dangerous mix. And last year was when the legislature changed the law so that you did not need a permit to carry a concealed weapon. But really the issue is without a permit, there was then no background check conducted, and then there was no safety training requirements. So we don't know whether these people who are carrying concealed weapons actually know how to use it and know how to store it properly and those sorts of things. Which only makes sense that, you know, when people take a responsibility like owning a gun, that there then is some requirement for safety training.
Again, Hildy Sizo is president of Arizonans for Gun Safety. Charles Heller is founder of the Arizona Citizens Defense League. He also hosts an AM radio program in southern Arizona on politics and gun rights. And Charles Heller, it's good to have you on our program.
Hi, thank you for having me on, Warren. I want to state out loud and clear, I'm not the founder. I'm one of only four. I'm only one of four founders.
Oh, okay.
I'm a co-founder and of the Arizona Citizens Defense League, and the program is called America Armed and Free. And also, I am a firearms instructor. Have been since the very beginning at the Arizona Concealed Weapons Permit Program for 17 years now. And I've had 2 to 3 classes a month consistently for the last 17 years, training people in the safe and effective use of firearms and other things in self-defense.
Well, should that be required by the law?
No, because you don't want to load up a right with prior restraints. There should be a lot of sanctions for people who misbehave with firearms. We actually, one of the things that people almost out to a person, especially in the media, miss is that the law that took away the restriction on carrying a concealed weapon without a permit also made it from a misdemeanor to a felony. It upped it to a felony to carry a concealed weapon in the commission of a violent crime. So in addition to making it easier on law-abiding people, we made it much tougher on criminals.
What about a background check?
Well, again, you're talking about using a prior restraint on a right. There's no particular reason to do a background check. Okay, it's in the law. It's probably going to stay in the law, and we can live with that. But remember, by the way, Mr. Montini's demeanor and attitude is so professional. I really appreciate his trying to be neutral on the issue, but there's a factual error. number one, there is no gun show loophole. Your background checks are absolutely done at gun shows, just like they're done anywhere else, but by dealers. By private parties, they're not done. Now, that doesn't matter whether it's at a gun show or away from a gun show. I operate a local radio tradio program here in Tucson, and people can call in and buy, sell, or trade anything, I say, as long as it's lawful and moral. So if they want to sell their gun over the radio, they can do it. It's perfectly lawful. So to say there's no background checks at gun shows, heck, I'm standing in front of the Tucson Convention Center right now, and we have gun shows here, and there's plenty of background checks that go on here at the gun shows.
Ed Montini, back to you, a columnist at the Arizona Republic. What do you say to that, the gun show loophole? You say it
well,
exists,
if you're a federal firearms dealer, you have to run background checks. But if you're a private seller, you do not. And so the fact that's the loophole. The fact of the matter is that some people, and this is not just, and I think you'd have to back that up. I've been to a number of gun shows. When you think of a private dealer, you think a guy who has four or five weapons from his closet or something. He's got a little table with. And this is not entirely true. These are some of the people who are quote unquote private dealers, for whom they are not required to make background checks, have quite an arsenal that they can sell. Now, I think that's a mistake. Now, but the fact is, he's also correct that there are ads in newspapers here. You can purchase a weapon from a private seller at any time in Arizona, and that's perfectly legal. So even if there were a gun show, even if this so-called gun show loophole were closed, that would not prevent a lot of private sales in Arizona from taking place, because it's part of the culture here. It's what's probably going to go on, and that's just part of how we are here.
So, Charles Heller, whether you call it a loophole or not, if you don't need to get a background check for a private sale, that's still whether you call it a loophole or not, doesn't seem to me to matter. That's still a limitation on the restrictions on gun sales.
Calling it a limit, but calling it a loophole, though, is what we call it is freedom. It's a lawful item. It's just like selling your car or any other thing, which could be misused. And as long as a person possesses it legally, and as long as they sell it to someone who's eligible to possess it legally, there is no restriction against it. However, there are many strong federal laws. For instance, if you're in a gun show and a person comes to you and says, I'd like to buy that gun, and you say to him, great, are you an Arizona resident? And he says, no, you may not legally sell that gun. And I see a lot of people refuse to do it. In fact, on my swap shop program, when people call in, and I'll ask them, you live in Arizona? And they'll say, yeah. And they'll tell me, I will only sell this to an Arizona resident with ID.
Hildy Sizo, back to you, president of Arizona's for Gun Safety. What do you say to Ed Montini's contention and Charles Heller's as well, that it's not the people who carry the guns and conceal them who cause the trouble? It's somebody else.
Well, I think that there's two issues we need to consider based on what occurred on Saturday, and that's really important in this debate. First is the shooter on Saturday was able to not only buy a Glock semi-automatic, but an ammunition clip that held 33 bullets. So he was able to shoot off 33 bullets in less than 1 minute. And that's why the impact was so grave in terms of the number of dead and injured. And I think we need to consider, should that sort of an ammunition clip really be available so widely in our society, so that some dangerous event like that perhaps could not have been, maybe have not such grave of an outcome. The second thing is I do think we need to reconsider background checks. Because do we really want someone, this shooter was known to have had a drug abuse background, he was banned from his community college, he was not allowed into the military, yet he could walk into a gun store and he could pass a background check and purchase a weapon. So I do think those are issues that are an important part of this the debate about gun laws, and perhaps can be directly linked to what occurred on Saturday.
You said there's a problem with background checks, but he did pass one. Are you suggesting then that existing background checks need to be changed in some way?
Well, I think that there's lots of loopholes in our background checks. You know, the law says that someone who has a domestic violence restraining order is a prohibited possessor of a firearm. Those who have been adjudicated in a court of law as mentally ill, and a variety of other categories of people would be prohibited to purchase a firearm. Yet that information is typically not in the FBI database. And for Arizona, that's where the background checks are occur, is through the FBI database. So there's a lot of missing information in that database. So we don't catch a lot of people that would be considered a prohibited possessor. We loosely define that somebody who has a drug abuse background is a prohibited possessor, yet that information is not really kept in a way that someone's prohibited. So, yeah, there's lots of loopholes, and I think those could be tightened up. And I think that, you know, when we do these public opinion polls and we ask our citizenry very specific questions, you know, should a mentally ill person have access to firearms? Should someone be able to take a firearm into a bar where alcohol is served? Should concealed weapons be allowed to be carried on campus, college campuses, where young people live? And typically, you know, overwhelmingly, the public will say no in almost all of those circumstances. Even the public opinion polls of firearm owners have basically disagreed with not having a permit process to carry a concealed weapon. Because I think for the majority of our citizenry, we are very sensible and know that with rights come responsibilities and that everybody should have protections. And so let's just be smart about how we decide who should carry a firearm and how it's carried in our society so that everybody can feel safe and children can be protected.
Hildy Saiso, president of Arizonans for Gun Safety. Charles Heller, I'll get back to the permit issue in a moment. But if, in fact, people are carrying guns essentially for self-defense, why do they need a 33-bullet clip? Why do they need to be able to fire that many bullets in less than 1 minute?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Well, for one thing, choice. If a person's not going to misbehave with the 19 rounds, that's a Glock 17, it holds 19 rounds. If a person's not going to misbehave with 19 rounds, they're not going to misbehave with 33. If they are going to misbehave with 33, they're going to misbehave with 19. If your argument is that if they had a smaller magazine, they could shoot less people, I would advise you to try counting to two, because all a person has to do then is have a second Glock with the same amount of ammo in it, and that's called the New York reload, a second gun. And now they have 34 rounds instead of 33. What attempting to enforce an artificial limit or ban like that ends up pushing you into perverse consequences. It's just like the assault weapon ban that said you couldn't have a gun that held more ammunition. So what the industry did was they said, okay, we can't put out magazines, guns that shoot more than 10 at a time. Great, we'll make the guns smaller and then therefore easier to conceal. And we'll take, seeing as how we have all that room in the gun, that empty room in the magazine, we'll put in bigger cartridges. The net result was you had a smaller, more lethal gun as the result of the assault weapons ban.
So, in other words, the gun manufacturers can get around the rules. Hildy Saiso, what do you say to that?
Well, I think that there were loopholes in the law when these expanded magazine clips were banned as a part of the assault weapons ban back about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. There were loopholes in the law that allowed no new ammunition clips, but ones in circulation could keep being sold and used. And so there really wasn't the opportunity to see if the law worked properly. But I think that the sensible person, if you ask them, should those type of ammunition clips, those expanded ammunition clips, where you can fire off round after round after round, is that necessary in our society? Is that something that, you know, is good and useful when it can have such devastating consequences? I mean, we've got to be balanced here and look at the right versus the devastating consequences.
Okay. Yeah, let me go back to E.J. Ed Montini, a political columnist at the Arizona Republic, a confessed former Easterner that you are. You've now gotten used to the gun laws in Arizona. But what about the point that Hildy Saiso made that for kids between 15 and 17, the top cause of death is gun violence. And what about this? The Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive Unit of the federal government says that Arizona is a net exporter of guns seized in crimes. 1,637 first purchased in Arizona recovered at the scenes of crimes out of state. Do those things concern you?
Well, sure they do, yeah. And I think that the I also think that it's a ludicrous argument, among those who are the most gun proponents to suggest that someone should just be able to get a magazine clip like the one used by the shooter in Tucson. Is it really that much to ask to say no, you shouldn't be able to have a weapon that fires off 30 shots? I think not. I think that if 19's not sufficient, then I'm sorry. Go get another weapon. And the fact is, it doesn't make it easier because carrying two guns it's harder to conceal two weapons than it is to conceal one. And so, frankly, no, I don't buy that argument. And I think that if everyone here were just to apply a little bit of common sense, we could get along. But the problem is that arguments on both sides of this issue, they always go to the slippery slope notion that if we yield one thing here, they're going to come eventually and confiscate our weapons, which is ludicrous.
Okay. Charles Heller, let's assume that the two of you disagree with regard, and the three of you, I should say, on how big the magazine ought to be. But what about this issue of the death rate among kids 15 to 17 and the exportation of guns that are used in crimes in other places?
Well, first of all, you've got to look at that contextually. Part of the reason that's true is Arizona has a high rate of burglaries and also has a very, very high rate of auto thefts. And the laws that create disarmed victim zones where people can't bring their gun force people to leave their guns in their cars in a lot of places. As a result, because they can't carry them with them, their car gets stolen or broken into, and you get a lot of guns that get into the marketplace that way. I love you all, but you're all looking in the wrong direction. You ought not to be looking at who purchases guns. You ought to be looking at how to stop people when they do things like this. We need more armed and trained people, citizens, civilians, who are the militia, and to stop things just exactly like the two people who tackled Jared Loughner. That's exactly what we need, and
they didn't shoot him.
Pardon me?
They didn't shoot him.
They didn't have to. One of the people who helped tackle him was armed, all right? And as is the case in almost all defensive gun uses, the gun is never fired.
That's all the time we have for this rebroadcast of To the Point. Thanks to Charles Heller with the Arizona Citizens Defense League, Heidi Saizo with Arizonans for Gun Safety, and Ed Montini, political columnist at the Arizona Republic. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl, Karen Radziner, and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.